Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello! Welcome back to another edition of our archaeogastronomical podcast, The Delicious Legacy. I am your designated gastro explorer and host of the show, Tom Dinas. Sit back, relax, and enjoy another episode of our travels through space and time. And today, we're not going to go so far into the past, and we're not going to travel too far away from where we are now, really. I found some interesting stories that I wanted to explore of English cuisine and English food and ingredients. And some of them, they're traditional stuff that you might have heard of, and some others, well, they aren't really. They seemed a bit unique to me and a bit worth exploring, really. Because it is traditional food. It's old, not thousands of years old, but there are recipes that they seem to be embedded on the character of the region and that they are from. And they are, well, to my eyes, first of all, they tell something about the story of the place and the story of the people from these places that we're going to talk about. And they do sound tasty, at least to my tastes and to my palate. And also, I think it tells us something, gives us a better picture of English food, and not that strict, very bland and grey picture that we have of equally of boring English food, but also bland food, with exceptions of fish and chips and a Sunday roast dinner with all the trimmings, which, of course, they are delicious. You have lots of different bits and bobs, and they make a beautiful plate. But apart from those generic stuff, and of course, the myriad of delicious British cheeses, that they are exceptional, to be honest. Yeah, the British food and English food particularly has a very bad reputation. So I think we can explore that and correct some misconceptions. There are some famous quotes that tell you all you need to know about how bad is the reputation of British food around Europe, at least. So, for example, there is one quote which I don't know who said it first, but they say, "The British Empire was created as a byproduct of generations of desperate Englishmen roaming the world in search for a decent meal." Or there's another one from Jacques Chirac, the president of the French Republic. Allegedly, he said in a summit, in a European summit, that you cannot trust people who have such bad cuisine. Great Britain is the country with the worst food after Finland. I mean, that's a very bad thing to say anyway. It's a very faux pas for both countries. But also, it's very unfair. It's a very unfair reputation that English cuisine has around Europe, to my eyes and in my opinion anyway. And there is an element of truth in terms of that after World War II, a lot of traditional foods disappeared and traditional recipes gone away to be replaced initially with simpler stuff because of the situation after World War II. But also there was a movement, you know, very violent in a way, movement towards mass industrialization of food, which I mean, forced people to move along as well. It was a forceful and forced decision. It wasn't natural in a way, so it took a lot of the traditional recipes and a lot of the traditional food, the cheap cuts of meat, the regional products of you know, fruits and jams and relishes, hams, cheeses, and all that stuff, to create a more uniform, a more bland, and a more very, very cheap to produce food, but not tasty and not to the character of its region, really. So it brought a uniformity to the British cuisine, which it didn't serve well as an ambassador to the great British produce that is around these isles. Admittedly, the last I guess now around 20 years now, there's been giant steps have been made by the culinary world here in Britain and in England specifically, and they celebrate the produce a lot more. And of course, they use a lot of more of the traditional products, and a lot of recipes have been revived, especially for cheeses, but also for hams. Yeah, there is a bit of a cause of celebration and optimism here. Contrast that to the European cuisine, that not only food is very cheap for the masses, perhaps not so cheap as the supermarket food in UK. And here is the trick, that we have very cheap, abundant product from supermarkets, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's A, healthy, and B, tasty. Yes, it's cheap, and we cover our calorific needs more than we need. So there's the problem of obesity here, but also it's a lot of ready-made food, a lot of sugar, a lot of fat, but bad fat, a lot of empty calories here. And of course, we have taken away the choice and the knowledge from the people that they can cook cheap, delicious, nutritious, healthy meals at home, which of course is a very, very big conversation here, and I'm not an expert and I'm not going to solve it. But I think because we've taken all the knowledge and we have lots of cheap food from supermarkets, we lost here in UK and especially in England, we lost our traditional recipes, forgot them, and yeah, a lot of cheap ingredients which people used to rely on, and cheap cuts of meat and local fruits and vegetables have been discarded in a way. So all this cheap choice that you had as a poorer person or a person that cannot afford these elements has been replaced by ready-made meals from supermarkets. Okay, I will conclude this rant by saying that if we compare and contrast this with the peasant European cuisine, we notice that the ingredients that they use, for example, tomatoes, peppers, feta cheese, olives, and so on, they've been important here as more or less luxury items or items for the middle classes and above, and they are expensive. And it seems to be like an aspirational thing, which some of the poorer classes, perhaps, they cannot achieve because it's out of their budget. So we discarded all the beautiful produce, cheap, fresh, abundant produce from the British Isles. And kind of concluding this rant and bringing everything together, I'm just going to explore some traditional ingredients and food from northern England. Specifically, I think I'll be northwest and Lancashire, Yorkshire mainly, and the lakes. And yeah, we'll find some ingredients that they really clicked and filled my imagination with delicious thoughts. Some of these food items you're going to see, they're part of the identity of the people from each region we're going to explore. I'm going to start with the cheese. I'm going to see Ribblesdale cheese from Northwest England, the region of Ribblesdale, which is in Yorkshire. Apologies for my pronunciation of places, but I'm not an expert in pronouncing a lot of these fairly unknown places in the north. So Ribblesdale cheese, it's a pressed, pasteurized milk cheese. It's made from cows, goats, and sheep's milk. Not all together. There are different versions made, and then you have different versions like plain or smoked or with garlic. For the sheep cheese, it's about 1.2 kilograms. For goat, about 1.7. And if it's from cow milk, about 2 kilograms. So the form is a flat wheel. And the color is almost white, and the curd is waxed. The flavor is firm, nutty, and mild. So Ribblesdale, on the west of the Pennines, probably shared the general cheese-making traditions of all the dales. The area has long been known for mild pressed cheeses. Both sheep and cow milk types are recorded. No documentary evidence for cheese-making in the dale has been found, but artifacts such as a stone weight from the press at Ashes Farm, where the Ribblesdale cheese is made, indicate that it was made there in the past. The modern cheese was evolved by the Hill family using Wensleydale recipes during the 1980s. So here we have an old recipe, an old cheese that production stopped and then somebody revived it in the 1980s. And yeah, I mean, it's one cheese that you don't really find in the supermarkets, to be honest. So I was very intrigued by it. So I searched on the internet. And yeah, you can find it in cheese shops around UK. So yeah, that's my first food item from the north. Next one, I have a fruit. And it's a pickled damson from northwest England, but from the Lake District area. And this pickle is dark red with a whole fruit visible. The flavor is sweet and sour, with a distinct, rich plum taste, lightly spiced. It's not very clear when the first plums planted there, up in the Lake District. But they are especially valued in the northwest of England. And there are many, many old orchards. Damsons have been associated with Westmoreland for over 150 years. There were several methods of preserving them, including jams and fruit pastes. Another obvious way to preserve them was pickle in vinegar and sugar. They were the only locally produced fruit available in sufficient quantity for this type of product, as the area does not support the large orchards and market gardens found in the southeast. The technique of producing it is a mixture of spirit or malt vinegar, sugar and spices, mainly cloves and cinnamon, which is boiled to make a syrup. Each damson is pricked several times and added to this syrup. They are cooked in the pickle for 10 minutes, then potted. Some cooks crack the stones and add the kernels. I think maybe this one will go well with the cheese. I'm not entirely sure, but yeah, that's something that I haven't tried yet. So this pickled damson recipe. But again, that's another traditional recipe from the north west of England. This is from the north of England in Calderdale in South Yorkshire, and it's a dock pudding. It's basically a brownish green puree. Its flavor is salty and spinach-like. This spring dish, regarded as a blood purifier, is associated with South Yorkshire and the Lake District, where it is known as Easter Ledge. It is made from common plants which appear early in the year and probably aided the health of the population by providing necessary vitamins after a long winter diet of preserved and salted foods. In composition, it amounts to a vegetable porridge. Essentially, it is now a poverty food based on groats. So groats are basically husked, crushed oats with wild greenery. Again, we can see the origins of this food, really, really simple and really, really. I mean, it's free. You have to go and collect it from the hills and the countryside, and that's something that probably started from the very, very, very poor people and the agrarian societies of the north, which they needed some supplement to their diet, and obviously some vitamins and minerals and so on. So it has been documented in the Lake District as early as early 19th century, when tourists started finding the area interesting. So we have documents since then. The notes for the herbs used include bistort, nettles, lady's mantle, black currant, and raspberry leaves, dandelion, plus onions, chives, cabbage, and lettuce. Apparently, Victorians realized its value to the poorer classes. There's a recipe for sweet dogs with oatmeal, and this was included in Alexis Sawyer's Shilling Cookery for the People in 1856 edition. Obviously, production is now limited and mostly domestic, but it's still made for sale in Cardledale, a valley in the southern Pennines. Also, there is a dog pudding competition held in the village of Maitholmroyd, West Yorkshire, every May. The preparation for this dish, for this green puree, is pretty simple, I think. You get the vegetable ingredients, which are pretty simply bistort and nettles and all the other herbs that you desire. You wash them and you strip them from their stems. Then you chop it with onion, add some seasoning, and they're cooked in water for 20 minutes. Then oatmeal is added, and the mixture is cooked for 20 minutes more. You then strain the mixture. At this point, it can put into a jar or deep frozen. And to reheat, it is cut in slices and fried in bacon fat for breakfast. It was used to accompany veal in the Lake District. Another produce from the northwest of England, in Cumbria, it's the Hedwick Macon ham, which is made obviously from lamb, Hedwick lamb, which is a heritage and very, it's not popular per se variety, but it's a very well-known variety between butchers and farmers and so on. What's that Macon ham? Whole smoked cured hams made from sheep meat that they weigh around 3 kilograms with bone in. The color is very dark red, translucent lean with streaks of pale, creamy gold fat. Dark gold outside. The flavor is pronounced gamey lamb flavor with herb undertones and mild smoke. This, to me, sounds like heaven. I don't know why it's not more popular. It's a dish that it's a ham that I will definitely eat more often if I could find it. The history behind it, obviously, we know ham is associated with cured pig meat, but it has a broader meaning of the hind leg of any animal, especially those killed for meat. So there is recipes for goat hams cured in Wales and other regions until the late 18th century. And I know that might sound a bit weird, and there was also badger hams. The use of mutton, which is a sheep over 1 year old, to make hams is also a long British tradition, which lingered in the more remote uplands. The word Macon was a hybrid, so mutton plus bacon, of the Second World War, to describe mutton cured as bacon, an innovation that took advantage of the excess of the Highland sheep at a time when pigs were an increasing rarity. Another solution adopted with enthusiasm by both the Ministry of Food and the population as a whole was urban backyard pig keeping, a skill that fallen out of favor since the Industrial Revolution. We have a recipe from, I'm sorry for the pronunciation again, Hannah Glass, from 1747, which gives instructions for dry curing mutton hams with salt and sugar, followed by smoking and boiling. Recipes were also found in 19th century books on curing meat. In the modern era, mutton hams were a rarity, although the idea was preserved in some parts, notably the Lake District. There's an old recipe for brining a mutton ham in a mixture which included molasses and spices, before drying and smoking. Until recent years, they were produced by only a few families for their own use. Modern interest in unusual foods has led to a revival of commercial production by a company based at Corney in Cumbria. The preserved ham would once have been soaked and boiled, then eaten with bread at ordinary meals. Those made today are eaten raw. The manufacturer suggested with fruit in the manner of Italian air-dried hams. The technique is pretty straightforward, as we've seen. There's a local sheep breed, the Hedwig lamb, that provides the meat. They are killed at 2 to 3 years old, so we have mutton here. And also crossbred sheep are used to provide larger hams. The hams remain in a dry cure of spiced salt for about 3 weeks. They are cold smoked over oak and juniper, then matured for 8 months. This sounds delicious to me. This sounds something that I really, really want to taste. Please find me some Hedwig. Make one, please. I'm salivating now.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Continuing with the theme of sheep, I'll go to the Isle of Man for their sheep, which is the Manx Longton sheep, which are have a brown coat and they are two-horned. So they're very, very distinctive and characteristic animals. They're quite rare, and they were saved from extinction in around 1913, when a display was organized for an agricultural show by John Elwes. At this time, the breed, as I said, it was almost extinct, but a few people on the Isle of Man were sufficiently enthusiastic to conserve their flocks. So, with the formation of the Rare Breed Survival Trust about 35 to 40 years ago, this led to a renewed interest. So, there are several flocks established on the mainland, and one was established on the Gulf of Man, an almost uninhabited island at the southern end of the isle, as a conservation measure against outbreak of disease amongst the main flocks. So the meat of this Isle of Man sheep will be really unique, I reckon. Unfortunately, that's another thing that I haven't tried, which really pinpoints the problem here with the regional food that we can't really find it unless we travel to the specific area. And yet we find all these variations of hams from Italy and sausages and wines from Spain and so on and so on. You understand my point here, I suppose. The rolling hills of the Isle of Man are in a mild maritime climate with no great extremes of temperature, but very, very windy. The native flora is grass and heather, and the land is generally well drained. So the breed has developed to be hardy, grazing the unimproved grass of the higher land. It requires little or no supplementary feeding except before lambing. The ewes are good mothers and prolific milkers. Lambs are raised outdoors with little human intervention. The breed is slow maturing and does not run to fat. As a meat sheep, there is some interest in crossing it with lowland terminal sires to give commercial lamb for the mass market. However, it's difficult to find it here because abattoirs dislike the carcasses because they do not conform to official grading, and due to legislation from the last century, the butchers of the Isle of Man are not allowed to identify the meat as coming from monks longthorns. The breed society is working to overcome these problems, and there is now some interest in the sheep as a local speciality. The lean meat is dark, close-grained, with very good flavor. Okay, next recipe. It's from Hawkshead in Cumbria, and it's the Hawkshead Wig. This is an oval bread roll, 70 millimeters long and 40 millimeters wide and 40 millimeters deep. The weight is about 40 grams. The color is golden with a shiny top. The flavor is that of a plain bread, lightly spiced with caraway. The wigs, sometimes spelled with an H after W or with a double G, were light textured white bread raised with yeast. The origin of the name is not clear. It is possibly derived from a Teutonic word meaning wedge. In some later recipes, the wigs are formed into rounds quartered by a cross, allowing them to be broken into wedges after baking. Both buns and wigs are fine white breads connected with Lent. Samuel Pepys wrote that he had a Lenten supper of wigs and ale in 1664. Buns were early defined as Lenten bread. The word possibly derives from the old French bougne, later beignet, a small something which puffs up, as fine white bread leavened with yeast would do. Wigs were thought of in the same terms. They were obviously made with fine white flour, and the 15th century reference equates them with buns. In restoration time, they were defined as white bread, molded long ways and thick in the middle. By the time we have the first recipes, these buns were sweetened, enriched with butter, and usually spiced with coriander or caraway. So in the Magazine of Domestic Economy in 1840, we have a recipe that requires cream, butter, sugar and spices, including caraway seeds. Irrespective of the connection with Lent, wigs do crop up as a festive food eaten at particular times. They are specially eaten in different locations at different times. So we have Christmas for Shrewsbury, St. Catherine's for Buckinghamshire, where the shape of the wigs is oblong, and in St. Andrew's Day in Bedfordshire. From 1850s, they seem to be mentioned much less frequently. It is possible that the name simply went out of current use. In 1932, Florence White found that rolls known as wigs were still made and sold in the small town of Hawkshead. According to Phyllis Graham, a native, they are still known and occasionally made in the locality, although little interest is taken in them. Only one commercial producer has so far been located. So Hawkshead wigs are plain and include lard, the recipe nowadays. None of the sugar, butter and milk of the early recipes. An ordinary dough is set to rise. It is knocked back and softened lard, 8 parts dough to 1 part lard, is kneaded in. together with a small quantity of caraway seeds. The mixture is scaled off into portions of about 40 grams, shaped into ovals, and allowed to rise again. The tops are brushed with milk and sugar. The buns are baked for 20 to 30 minutes at about 220 degrees Celsius. You see, there's another fascinating recipe, specific to a region and tied to local customs, which most of the European food that we eat conforms to these norms. But if it comes from France or Italy or Spain, it's considered delicacy and it's expensive. If it comes from Cambria, well, there's not even a recipe surviving, almost. And of course, there's only one commercial producer making it. There is an element of snobbery of the simple, tasty regional food from England, really, isn't it? Okay, moving on. I'm going to talk about something you might find a bit gross. Again, I think it's a recipe of importance because it gives you information on what simple poorer people in classes used to eat, and that's cowheel. Yes, you did hear correctly, cowheel. Now, obviously, calves' feet were delicacies, and they were treated like pig's trotters or made into the delectable jelly, or they used in fine cookery as in stews or stocks or sauces. Cowheel, on the other hand, was altogether more substantial, strongly gelatinous and containing much gristle. It took long time to become tender. An early mention in a work by the 17th century physician Thomas Mouffet shows it was considered a valuable restorative, but generally it did not figure in dainty cookery books. Martha Barley, in 1756, was one of the few who proposed using cowheel at genteel tables. Though it may have been an ordinary sound, it makes a very rich and fine soup, very few exceeding it. Apart from occasional appearances in standard Victorian works, such as Mrs. Beaton in 1861, it was probably mostly left to the poor. It was usually boned before eating. The flavor is bland, but its gelatinous texture is the important thing that is valued. Cowheel can be eaten cold with vinegar and salt, or cut up and made into a stew with a white sauce, or added to a richer mixture with beef and vegetables. Tasty little morsels or relishes, such as brawn or corned beef or boiled mutton, saveloys, tripe, pig's trotters, sausages, and of course cowheels, were part of what the fathers used to eat. It was the father's tea alone. And there are also recipes from the French that contained cowheel. By the 1940s and 50s, cowheel was associated with North Country, and it was a favorite standby in cattle market towns, and it was made into jellied brawn. Cowheels generally were prepared by tripe dressers, and generally this is because a tripe set of offals from a cow consisted of the tripe, feet, reed, and the windpipe. And they were given, as I said, by the tripe dressers. So the cowheels come from animals over of 8 months or older. And after washing, scalding, and removing of the hair and hooves, they're cooked by boiling for 3 to 4 hours, then cooled, drained, and dressed. And this is from Northwest England and Lancashire. Now let's check some fishy stuff. One fish that you might know is char, but you might know the Arctic char, which is actually lives in the Arctic, obviously. But there's also char who lives in the Lake Windermere and the lakes generally, as locked populations survive throughout Europe as well, which are remnants of Arctic char, which was trapped after the last ice age. Generally, they have a limited range to deep lakes where the waters maintain a temperature of less than 20 degrees, below 20 degrees in the summer. There are a few such lakes in England, all in the northwest, but it's also found in some places in the way in Wales and Scotland. Mrs. Beaton, again, in 1861, said the largest and the best kind is found in the lakes of Westmoreland, and as it's considered a rarity, it's often potted and preserved. Char is a fish similar to trout, with reddish skin on the underside, and they are noted for the delicate flavor. As a delicacy, barrels of potted char were sent to the royal court in the 15th century and mentioned in form of pies in the 17th century. The pie seems to have been the first method of preserving the food. It seems like from correspondence from the Restoration period, giant pies were sent down to London to give exiled Cambrians a taste of home, or to persuade politicians of the worth of an applicant's cause. Between 1670 and 1680, the experiment was made of substituting pottery for pastry, and the potted char was born. Not many years later, the intrepid traveller Celia Fiennes appreciated char potted with sweet spices by an innkeeper in Kendal in 1698. As we can well understand and appreciate, potted fish, it was a storeroom constant before the rapid transport and refrigeration of the modern era, which permitted distribution to all classes in all places. So obviously to make the fish stable in any climate, it had to be either salted, dried or smoked, or pickled or potted. And all these methods were part of the methods pursued in the early British kitchens, if for no other reason than to avoid monotony of flavour. Apart from potted shrimps and potted crab, I'm not sure if we have many of these different preserving methods available to our everyday cooking and from our supermarkets and food places nowadays. There was a whole industry for potting char. The fish were cleaned, spiced and packed in attractive dishes made especially for the purpose, then covered with butter and cooked. In this form they kept well, and they were exported to the rest of Britain. Obviously, the fishery went into decline in 1860 due to overfishing by netsmen, and the stocks recovered slightly as a result of official restrictions, and of course all netting was forbidden. But they have never reached their former heights. Some fish are still taken, and now char is usually grilled for lunch or dinner. In Lake Windermere, a distinctive method of fishing is employed. It requires a rowing boat to support two rods, each of which bears a vertical line weighted with 750 grams lead weights. At intervals from each vertical line, six horizontal lines are trailed, each bearing 6 to 10 spinners or lures, the theory being that fish swimming at different depths can be caught. The boat has to be kept in constant motion so that the lines trail correctly and do not become tangled. For our following food item, we're going to go back to the Isle of Man, and we're still staying with the fish, and we're talking about Manx Keepers. Cold smoked Manx Keepers are about 22 centimeters, including head and tail, and they weigh approximately 120 grams. The skin is dark grey-brown on the back, fading to silver on the belly, with a distinctly gold tinge. The flesh is dark golden-brown. The flavour is mild, fishy, mellow, with the salt being more dominant over the smoke, and it's quite oily. So we all head of keepers and smoked keepers. The Isle of Man is good base for which to catch the herrings, and it's an island tradition of salting and curing them to make either barreled salt herring or red herrings. They were much more common in the past, and especially for export. Keepered herring, made to the cure developed by the John Woodger from Northumberland, first became popular in the 1840s. And the process must have spread rapidly to other parts of the country. The cure used for keepers on the Isle of Man is similar to that used elsewhere. The herring are prepared by splitting and cleaning. They are then brined for a short time, hung on tender hooks and smoked. There are several points which makes the monk's keeper unique. Firstly, they're always undyed. Secondly, the excellence of the herring, which have a fat content and composition which render them highly usable for this type of cure. Fish caught early in the season, which is from June to August, are best, and those from Irish boats, which fish in pairs with one net between two boats, are preferred, as the fish landed by these are in excellent condition with no bruising. Finally, there is the skill and attention given to them during the smoking. Peter Canepa, who smokes the fish for Devereaux and Son, uses a smoke temperature higher than that used elsewhere and remarks that timing is crucial to quality. This depends on the fish's size and oil content and ambient temperature. Now, this is a fish that I had a few times, luckily, one of the recipes that I had a couple of times, and I can attest that it's a really, really delicious smoked fish, which I highly recommend. All this talk about food makes me really hungry now. Finally, to conclude our unusual foods tour of Northern England, let's see some sweets. So we'll start with a Wilfred tart, which is a double crust pie with a decoration of three pastry leaves around the central vent, about 120 to 130 millimeters in diameter and 20 millimeters deep. The weight is about 350 grams. It has a pale gold pastry color with yellow melted cheese showing through the central hole. The flavor is crisp, unsweetened pastry with a filling of sweetened apple and a layer of cheese. Wilfred tarts are made in the town of Ripon in North Yorkshire. The name is a corruption of Saint Wilfrid, which was a bishop of York and a monk at Ripon, and he lived in 1634 to 709 AD, and is the patron of the town's cathedral. The tarts are made for a procession held in his honour on the Saturday before the first Monday in August. This procession has a history which stretches back at least to the late Middle Ages. Earlier evidence about the tarts themselves are not forthcoming. Hence, the first description is in White in 1932, who noted them as small jam tarts or cheesecakes. Later sources comment that the tarts were handed out to passers-by or left on plates by house doorways for people to help themselves. There are at least two versions of this tart. And one is the apple and cheese that we mentioned, which is a version made for sale, and another recipe which calls for a filling of butter, ground almonds, sugar, lemon rind, soaked breadcrumbs, and egg. This last is similar to early almond cheesecake recipes, for instance from Eliza Smith's book in 1758. The origin of the apple and cheese combination is less obvious. English cooks were rather indiscriminate about the basis of their cheesecakes, which quite often contained no cheese, no curdled milk, but were based on eggs and almonds instead. It is possible that the current recipe is an evolution of a formerly more complex cheesecake, which included apples amongst its ingredients. The baker who now bakes it uses a recipe which belonged to the business which he acquired some 25 years ago, and he is the only producer. So the technique itself, obviously, it's an English short crust pastry which is used to line a deep pie dish, and the portion is rolled out for the top. A layer of sliced apples is placed at the bottom, brown sugar sprinkled over, and some grated cheese placed on top. This should traditionally be Wensleydale, but cheddar, which is deeper yellow, is used in preference. The pie is covered and decorated. It is baked at 180 degrees for about 40 minutes. And it may be eaten hot or cold. Now, I don't know about you, but for me, it does sound quite interesting and appetizing recipe. You have tart apples and nice melted cheese, I think there is something there. Definitely. Yeah, and a pint of ale, I guess. Sounds good to me. And now let's go to Cumberland again. Obviously, we have Cumberland sausages and Cumberland ham, which we know, and thankfully, they're still happening. They're still being produced. But this is a sweet one, and it's Cumberland rum butter. Rum as the drink, rum. It's a flavoured butter, sold in quantities of 110 or 220 grams. The color is cream yellow brown, depending on the type of sugar used. The flavor is spicy, sweet, and alcoholic. There is an association of rum butter with Cumberland since at least the late 19th century, when Joseph Wright was collecting information on his dialect dictionary, and he noted the association of the dish with the region and several customs linked with it. Rum butter was eaten by wives during their confinement and is offered to and is expected to be partaken of by visitors. The lady who first cuts into the bowl is predicted to require a similar compliment. Coins for the baby were collected in an empty bowl. The Oxford English Dictionary gives the first instance of rum butter in print as Mrs. A.B. Marshall's cookery book, 1887. The recipe probably predates this, as the ingredients are all traditional to Lake District cookery. It is also known in Cumbria as hard sauce. Today, a brandy-flavored version is also made. The recipe and method are simple and vary only in the scale of operation from domestic kitchen to commercial confectioners. Basically, unsalted butter is whipped to a cream, mixed with soft brown sugar and rum, and spiced to taste. The mixture is chilled until required. Light brown or muscovado sugar can be used as taste dictates. The proportions are 1 part per butter to 2 parts sugar. I will upload maps on Patreon with the places that I mentioned for all to see, and also post with each ingredient, food or recipe of the region for all of you to see. Now, isn't it interesting that all these regional recipes aren't more well known? Well, I think they deserve to be heard all over UK, and of course we need to taste them a lot more often. Some of them, yes, we can make them at home, and that's great. But some of it is very, very regional, and it's part of the identity of the people, but also gives us a better and clearer picture of how food around UK was produced 200 years ago or more. And I mean, this is part of the PGO and PGI status that a lot of European food has. And of course, a lot of this stuff there also, the British foods that I mentioned, they have this status too. And, you know, Britain and continental Europe possesses an enormous range of wonderful food. And of course, this system of PGO and PGIs, it's been developed by the European Union in 1992 to create systems for protected designation of origin and protected geographical indication to promote and protect regionally important foods, regionally important food products. For a protected designation of origin, a PDO, this describes a food that is produced, processed and prepared in a given geographical area using a recognized skill. A protected geographical indication, PGI, demonstrates a geographical link between a foodstuff and a specific region in at least one of the stages of production, processing or preparation. And this stuff, they have a link to the terroir of the region, the microclimate, the soil, the temperature, and the unique flora and fauna of the area that it comes from. All in all, I think we should celebrate these a lot more. And with this, I conclude my tour of unusual foods of Northern England. I hope you found something interesting here, and I would be interested to know your opinion on this strange and unique recipes. If you heard them before today, or if you have tasted something similar, or any of these food items I described above. So yeah, please get in touch and tell me your experiences with the foods. And that's it for today. I've been Thomas Dinas, and this was the Delicious Legacy Podcast. Have a lovely rest of the day. Remember to follow on Twitter, on Instagram, The Delicious Legacy. And if you want the podcast to be delivered to you earlier than the rest of the world, then become a patron on Patreon. So from $3 and above, you can get the podcast early and a lot of unique and exclusive writing, amongst other surprises. Thank you.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.